I'm Mark Hennick, and this is Modern Minds. Welcome to Modern Minds. I'm Mark Hennick. Today on the show, we're talking about psychedelics. Some say we've entered into a psychedelic renaissance. It's a renaissance in which we finally see the promise of novel treatments for some of the most common mental health problems like depression, anxiety, and addictions. Yet psychedelics continue to carry the stigma imposed by the war on drugs. They're still seen by some as dangerous, as strange, or sometimes merely just as unserious as a recreational trip. I've got two distinguished scientists on the show today to help dispel some of the myths around psychedelics and to help us to understand their therapeutic potential in the mental health space. Dr. Albert Garcia-Romo is going to join me in a little bit later. He's a member of the Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences faculty at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. His research focuses on the effects of psychedelics in humans, with a particular focus on psilocybin as an aid in the treatment of addiction. But first, Dr. Godfrey Perlson is a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at Yale University, and he's the founding director of the Olin Neuropsychiatry Research Center, a brain research center at the Institute of Living in Connecticut. He's published more than 700 peer-reviewed articles on marijuana, and now he's turned his superpowers toward psychedelics. So here's my conversation with Dr. Godfrey Perlson. Dr. Perlson, thank you so much for joining me on Modern Minds today.
Oh, you're more than welcome.
So we're talking in this episode about what some have been calling the psychedelic renaissance, or the explosion, it seems, of both research and clinical application in psychedelics in the mental health space. So you've written, of course, a lot, especially on cannabis in particular, not a psychedelic. So I'm interested in seeing how that experience has morphed into the psychedelic research that you're conducting at the Institute of Living now. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you're working on in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. So although cannabis has been around for thousands of years, and I will get into psychedelics in a second, one of the uses of cannabis historically has been as a psychedelic substance, and that in the right doses and given the right mental set, in the right setting, cannabis can function as a psychedelic. For example, in India, it's used to worship the god Shiva in various religious ceremonies that are very psychedelically tinged. But when we talk about psychedelics, we're really talking about so-called classic psychedelics that seem to have a similar mechanism of action, which is that they act on a type of serotonin receptor subclass, called the 5-HT2A receptor. And all of them glob onto that and switch it on for variable lengths of time. But having said that, there are a number of other drugs sort of around the periphery of that that work through very different mechanisms, biochemically, pharmacologically, but that have rather similar effects. So for example, the club drug MDMA is thought of as a kind of psychedelic, but it's really a substituted amphetamine compound. Ketamine, special K, is a club drug and anesthetic that's used now as an antidepressant. It also induces psychedelic-like experiences, but through a completely different mechanism.
Now, how does it differ, though? You mentioned particularly the mechanism of action on that serotonin receptor. Is that different from how treatment as usual in psychiatry reacts? In other words, antidepressants seems to be treatment as usual. Is that a different mechanism of action from antidepressants?
Yes, although antidepressants such as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRI drugs, like Prozac is the sort of first and most widely cited example, act on 5-HT2 receptors or on that system. They act at a different subclass of receptors through different mechanisms and have a vastly different time course. that do not produce psychedelic effects. How psychedelics act is in some ways even better understood than what we know about how antidepressant compounds such as SSRIs act. And there may be commonalities downstream, because there are immediate effects of these drugs, but there are also delayed effects, particularly on the growth of neurons, like nerve cells in the brain, how those nerve cells communicate with each other through sprouts and various processes that emerge from the neurons and make connections. So both sets of drugs may have that in common at some level, but again, over very different courses and through different mechanisms.
Another, well-known, or I think it's well-known, piece of the antidepressant side is that it can take several weeks, that delayed action that you mentioned, sometimes 6 weeks or more, just to start noticing something. And I think that's presented kind of a problem for psychiatry and for neuroscience. Why is that? Whereas with psychedelics, I've seen research where sometimes one treatment the change seems to happen. So what do we actually make of that? What are scientists saying here that would cause that to happen in psychedelics versus antidepressants?
Yeah, that's a great question, because that was an issue that was first raised when people began using ketamine as a fast-acting antidepressant. So this is a discovery that was made by John Crystal and his team at Yale many years ago. And people were very surprised that ketamine seemed to have immediate antidepressant effects that were very different than those of classic antidepressants, either tricyclics or SSRIs or allied compounds. So that's where that question was first raised. And psychedelics do seem to have similar, very quick onset antidepressant effects. But whether the psychedelic experience alone is sufficient to produce those, or if the effect has to be unpacked by a skilled psychotherapist and talked over and given relevance to the person's current functioning is an unanswered question. That is, if you or I were depressed and we took a psychedelic drug, would that be enough by itself? Or would you have to have someone sitting with you afterwards and unpack the experience for you? So that's something that current research is trying to follow up on. Another thing is the psychedelic experience itself really necessary? What would happen if you gave someone a psychedelic that lasted for 10 minutes, but was just as vivid, or put them to sleep with an anesthetic so they didn't experience the psychedelic part of it? Would the drug itself be sufficient? So there are many unanswered questions about psychedelics as antidepressants.
Do you think that it's two things happening at once here, or is it one or the other, wherein there's something neurologically changing in the brain that alleviates the symptomology, or somebody who goes through a psychedelic trip, sometimes it's not uncommon that they report really weird things, that it brings up a whole lot of stuff inside them, maybe processing it for the very first time. So is it a primarily psychological effect, or is it something physiological that's happening?
I think that's a key unanswered question in psychedelics research, that there are well-documented or increasingly well-documented neurobiological effects in terms of neuronal connections and neuronal sprouting that seem to begin quickly and continue for weeks. Then there are the immediate psychedelic effects. And we don't know whether either of those or both is necessary for the therapeutic effect. So I think we're sensing a theme here in our discussion, which is there are many things that are not well known and not well understood and are only recently beginning to be looked at. And that's a different context, which is that these drugs were prohibited for many years and scheduled as Schedule One by the government, which means that they all both have a potential to be highly addictive, which is not true of psychedelics, and have no known medical use whatever, which we now know is also probably not true. So people have, as you intuited at the beginning of our conversation, really begun to re-examine a lot of these, what we held to be true since the 1960s, and rethinking it.
So can you speak a little bit more about that piece? Because I think this is an enduring stigma around psychedelics when they got wrapped up in the war on drugs, the so-called war on drugs. you mentioned psychedelics aren't addictive, and is it possible to overdose on psychedelics as we know them? I know it's a big grab bag, but can you maybe dispel some of those myths around the risk of addiction, and if they lead down the same road as maybe, you know, heroin or crack cocaine?
So if you give psychedelic compounds to laboratory animals in classic reward paradigms where they press a lever to get more of the drug, then drugs such as cocaine and opioids, for example, are highly rewarding, and animals will work very hard to get more and more doses. Now, that's not true of cannabis under most models. It's also not true of psychedelics. And there's also a refractory period with psychedelics. So if I took LSD now and had a classic LSD trip experience that lasted 12 hours, and the next day I took more LSD, I'd have a reduced effect rather than an enhanced one. So there are sort of natural feedback mechanisms that make psychedelics less inherently abusable. And people tend to use them in particular circumstances, sometimes like MDMA in raves, for example. And because it's an amphetamine compound and not a classic psychedelic, it's much more abusable, as is ketamine. But classic psychedelics such as LSD or psilocybin, for example, are not abused in the same way, for example, as opioids or cocaine.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference that we know of? Yeah, like I say, or you said, there's a lot of unanswered questions here, and this surge in research is still relatively new, even though psychedelics have been around for a long time. But has there been a detectable difference in the synthetic psychedelics like LSD or ketamine or proprietary compounds versus so-called natural or organic compounds like psilocybin?
So part of the resurgence of psychedelics in recent years has been through a couple of routes. Well, one is through neuroscientists such as Roland Griffiths at Hopkins, who had like a deep background in addictionology and in animal models of addiction and a persisting interest in psychedelic compounds as therapeutics. And the other thread is through Michael Pollan's books and talks on psychedelics. I think it's that second route, because Michael Pollan is, amongst other things, a botanist and deeply knowledgeable in plants and plant compounds. To some extent, he has pushed more for natural compounds. I think it might be fair to say that. But there's been an upsurge in interest because of the therapeutic possibilities of ketamine. So there's that thread also running through at the same time. So both of those things are happening, both an interest in natural compounds and an interest in synthetics. But the other thing driving the interest in natural compounds is a resumed interest in natural healing and traditional healing methods, and healing methods used through herbal methods from other cultures. So ayahuasca is like a good example of that. It uses a DMT-like compound in a brew of various parts of tree bark and tree roots and vines and other things to release something that's rather like dimethyltryptamine or DMT, which is a classic psychedelic. So at that level, the two things interact with each other. The natural compounds and the synthetic compounds become one. So people have become interested in both of those things over the last 10 years or more.
I don't know if you can speak to this or not, but there's been very little, I think, exciting research in the, and maybe I'm wrong about this, but very little exciting research developments in terms of new antidepressants coming from pharma for a very long time. To the degree that it seems like, anyway, research largely didn't progress in that space. Is there, do you think, a corporate interest in developing proprietary psychedelic substances now? Is that part of why we're seeing a rush of research and funding and people in this race to patent a compound?
Yes, absolutely. People both have Well, there are mixed motives. People want to develop something that perhaps is shorter acting, needs less supervision, has less unpleasant side effects, and acts more efficiently. But on the other hand, they want to make money out of it. So there are always dual motives on the part of pharmaceutical and allied companies, some of which we can applaud and others not. Yes, but that's part of it. People want to both answer research questions that are unanswered, like how long does the trip have to last in the supervision? What about drugs that are very similar and cause neuronal sprouting, but don't give people a psychedelic experience and so on? So if there's something that could be taken once a day as a pill, lots of people would take it if it was effective. And what you said is perfectly true, that psychopharmacological research has ground not to a complete halt. I mean, there are new drugs like this combination of Wellbutrin plus an NMDA receptor drug that seem to be effective and to work more quickly. It's come on the market recently. But if some psychedelic-like compounds were readily available and had few side effects and were short-acting, then people would definitely jump on that if they were effective.
So then I guess where does all this leave the average patient? I mean, it's hard not to bump into news stories or new research on psychedelics now, but it's still largely unavailable, isn't that true?
Yes, and for reasonably good reasons, that as there's still such a lot we don't know about it in terms of safety and efficacy, who does it work for and under what circumstances, the questions that we just talked about in terms of how long does the trip have to be, how much supervision do you need, all this reinterpretation and so on. Until we've answered those, it's probably appropriate that we don't sort of leap in and give this to lots of people in an untested way. Best to figure out those questions first.
So what do you think is then the future of this psychedelic movement? Is this just a passing fad, or could there really be some paradigm-changing treatments that come out of this?
I think there's a real possibility for paradigm-changing treatments, that these are drugs that act through what we think is a relatively novel mechanism and time course, many people are interested in exploring them for exactly the motives that we talked about, that scientifically they may be helpful, it may help patients. Many patients with serious depression are refractory to current treatments of all sorts, including TMS and ECT and ketamine even. So there are people even beyond traditional antidepressants who are treatment resistant. We had something new that was useful and very effective and worked quickly, that would be great from a patient point of view. Then there are scientists like myself who want to answer questions about these compounds and how they work and when they work. And then, as we talked about, there are people who are investing in this in pharma companies and private companies who want to make money on this. So there's a convergence that probably argues that this will not go away and be a passing fad. But on the other hand, it's still relatively unexplored, so we really do need to find out more about it.
Well, thank you so much for the research that you're doing to find out more about it. Dr. Godfrey Perlson, thank you so much for joining me on Modern Minds today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Mental health is health. At the Institute of Living, we are pioneers in mental health, and we have been for 200 years. We have an ambition to transform mental health services while co-designing these services with those whom we serve. Together, we can reduce stigma, address discrimination, and increase access to care.
Welcome back to Modern Minds. I'm joined now by Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo. Thank you so much, Al, for joining me on Modern Minds today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I've got a couple of specific questions. We already had Dr. Godfrey Perlson on this episode so far, digging into some of the neuroscientific research around psychedelics. With you, I'd like to unpack more of the clinical application, as well as some more specific thoughts that I had arising out of his interview. First, I'm wondering if you can tell me a bit more about the latest research that you're working on over at Johns Hopkins.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've had a lot of expansion over the last few years. Our group has been working in multiple indications with psilocybin primarily, but looking at major depressive disorder for cigarette smokers who are trying to quit smoking. I currently have a couple of studies that are enrolling for people with early stage Alzheimer's disease or mild cognitive impairment, as well as folks with chronic Lyme disease. And we have some more work coming up down the pipe with smoking cessation as well. But that's just, you know, a small sliver of what we have going on. There's quite a lot happening in the field, which is pretty exciting.
And this is something that I've gotten from talking to others, too, is that there's a broad range of substances that can be used that fall into the sort of psychedelic basket. But then there's also a broad range of applications and protocols for applications as well. So are there any sort of commonalities or sort of general standards that we can apply across these? Or is it really just very different depending on the substance and depending on the application?
There are certain things that are common, I would say, across the different protocols. There's usually a period of preparation, drug dosing with the psychedelic medication, whether that be MDMA or psilocybin. Those are the ones that have been studied the most, but people are certainly studying others like ayahuasca. You know, there's interest in using LSD clinically and good data emerging. And then there's a whole host of other, substances that have not really been well studied, like 5-MeO-DMT and, mescaline and so on. So those are all exciting opportunities for new research. I think, the other thing that, is tailored between the different types of treatments is if you're working with somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder versus somebody with a substance use disorder versus someone with major depression, PTSD, existential distress from terminal illness. You know, each one of those individuals is going to be bringing a different set of issues to the table. And so we typically tailor the talk therapy and the supportive counseling around the dosing sessions to deal with those individual issues specifically.
So the way that I've sort of, I guess, worked it out in my own mind is that, and correct me if this is wrong, but there seem to be kind of three general stages or phases to how this happened. You mentioned the preparatory or the set and setting kind of piece. There's the application or trip itself, whether or not there actually is a psychedelic trip, a component of it, and then the integration or reentry piece on the end. So I'd like to talk about each of those phases and what's involved with them. How does somebody, a patient or their clinician for that matter, prepare for a psychedelic trip?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you have it absolutely right. There are those three phases. And actually, I kind of like to add a fourth phase on to the beginning because it's something that we do with all the clinical research. And I believe once this is, through any sort of medical approval process, that it's going to be necessary at the beginning of this in the treatment setting as well. And that's a screening. We do a really careful and intensive screening at the beginning of these types of treatments. And that includes a full physical examination, EKG, blood work. We do a mental health history to make sure that there's no personal or family history of things that could be contraindicated, including stuff like, psychotic illness, bipolar mood, anything that we think could be potentially risky for an individual to have a high dose psychedelic session, then we'll often, screen them out on the basis of some of those contraindications. So that always happens in the beginning part of the process for us. But what we then move on to, once we've screened folks and made sure that this is going to be safe for them, is this preparatory process, as you mentioned. And that's really a couple of things. One is getting to know the person, getting to know what their formative life events were, their worldview, what it is that they're dealing with in their life at the moment. And, we typically talk about this as a presenting issue, whether that be a substance use issue, whether that be terminal illness or, depressive mood. So we really like to dig into what are those symptoms look like and how are they affecting people's day-to-day life? And also start to set some treatment goals. How would we like things to go in this case? What would be helpful for them? Where would they like to see themselves in the future? That's a really important part of the preparatory process. We also go into getting to know them, not just in that level, but building a sense of personal rapport, trust, therapeutic alliance, as we often call it. That's just a really trust building that we need to do, I think, in order to make these types of high dose psychedelic sessions feel safe and comfortable for an individual when you're doing them. And the last thing that we do in the preparatory sessions is we spend specific time talking to people about what to expect during the drug sessions. And this is really kind of a laundry list of what have we seen others go through and what have we seen people experience in past sessions. And, you know, we've done this now in something like over 700 dosing sessions of psilocybin here at Johns Hopkins since 2000. And so with that experience, we're able to give people sort of a lay of the land about, you know, sometimes you might have intense emotional responses, sometimes you might have visual imagery, autobiographical memories. So by really preparing them, giving them an idea of what they can expect and how to navigate difficulties should they encounter those, that's the best we are able to do to really get people prepared before they go into these sessions. And that's usually what we're doing on the front end.
So in that acute phase of going through or experiencing the psychedelic trip itself, I imagine so much of it maybe has to do with the particular substance used, and you know, the intensity and the duration probably has to do a lot with the dosage and the particular substance. But what generally are some of those things that people pull up, and does it depend on what, I guess, the pre-existing contents of their mind? Is it amplifying stuff that's already in there, or is it inserting strange images into their mind?
Yeah, and so these are all largely a function of, as you noted, drug, dose, set, and setting. And so, you know, what substance are we using? I've mainly worked with psilocybin here at Hopkins, and so that's what I'll kind of focus on. But by using psilocybin, we can expect certain types of perceptual changes, certain changes in thinking, and certain emotional reactions, though these can vary widely across people. And so really what we're doing is we're kind of giving people a set of expectancies and telling them, this is what we've seen, but we can't predict exactly where you're going to go in these dosing sessions. And I think that's the honest way to approach this. Now, that being said, you know, we are typically using a relatively high dose in the range of 20 to 30 milligrams of psilocybin. And so in that range, you're starting to see not just those perceptual visual changes, for instance, with eyes open, but also with eyes closed, there can be elementary geometric patterns, shapes and colors. There can be more vivid imagery, including things like seeing landscapes. Sometimes there's re-experiencing of past memories. And so that autobiographical content can really come up. And that's really, you know, that's can be a function of set, you know, what's on a person's mind when they're coming into the dosing session. Or again, what have been some of the major life experiences that have been formative for them, which sometimes have come up in the sessions as material that needs to be processed further. Mm-hmm. And so we don't usually think of this as putting new material in there, but more so kind of pulling old material out from the back of the file cabinets, if you will. And oftentimes that can be really important for the therapeutic process, for people to be able to go back and revisit some of these memories. And, you know, in addition to a lot of this stuff, there can be at higher dose ranges, feelings of ego dissolution, including things like your sense of self dissolving. We often talk about this as a mystical type effect. There's a feeling of unity between oneself and the rest of the universe. And so that tends to be something that can be really helpful for many people, although it can also be very anxiety provoking. And so you get a range of intense emotional responses, anything from feelings of love and gratitude to more difficult emotions like fear, anxiety, and even paranoia can come up. And so we try to prepare people for that by giving them this full gamut of potential experiences that they may encounter beforehand.
Mm. It sounds like almost, and maybe this is why it seems to be so effective in trauma and related to trauma addiction, of course, because there's often a trauma history in addiction, but it almost sounds like exposure therapy. Like there's all this stuff inside there that you don't want to deal with, and it's opening the gates and letting it all come out, whether you like it or not. So that seems to really speak to the need for the psychotherapeutic piece on the other side.
Yeah, definitely. There can be elements of that exposure. Certainly when you're working with MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder, that's something that you see come up, is that some of these traumas will reemerge during the dosing sessions. And thankfully, the MDMA drug effects can help dampen some of the fear response and allow people to go back and into those memories and experiences without being necessarily overwhelmed by the intensity of the emotions. With psilocybin, though, the drug effects are a little different. And so if that type of intense experience or memory comes up, you know, we really have to do our best, like you said, to both provide a safe container during the experience, but then also to help integrate afterwards with appropriate aftercare and really make sure that people are able to make sense and meaning of the experience. And that's really what the whole third part of the process is about, is this integration of the experience and trying to parse out any insights that may have come through.
Now, on that piece, I'm interested in your opinion on this, because maybe it's all tied up with the war on drugs and the kind of fear campaign around psychedelics, especially, you know, LSD and things that might be a little bit more unknown to the general population. But do you think that there's any such thing as a bad trip? You know, that's the, it has a bad reputation, I think, as being scary and upsetting. But I've also heard the counter to that is that sometimes that brings up the most fruitful material for the psychotherapeutic phase after. Where do you stand on that?
Well, there's a couple of types of what you might consider bad trips. And, you know, we often talk about challenging experiences in the research that we do, and that's not uncommon. You might see that between 20-30% of the time at a high dose of psilocybin. And that's not necessarily dangerous or, you know, potentially bad for people, as you noted, because it can often bring up a lot of important content that they can then work with after the fact. However, it might be very unpleasant when it's happening. And that includes, you know, feelings, as I mentioned, of, you know, extreme anxiety, fearfulness, paranoia, and so forth. Now, when people are not in a controlled medical setting and they may have those types of experiences, they can also act in ways that would be uncharacteristic of them, and they may become disoriented and do things that would be dangerous, you know, whether that be get behind the wheel of a car, you know, put themselves or somebody else in a risky situation. And so those are the types of acute experiences that can be dangerous. And, you know, that's compounded by people who are using these substances, you know, outside of a controlled setting where they have somebody who's making sure that they're safe and staying contained. Now, the other type of challenging experience that come up that I would say is more in line with a proper bad trip is that for some people who have a predisposition, these high dose experiences can be extreme and also then lead to ongoing problems. So it's not just they had a bad time when they're on the drug and then the drug wears off and then they go to bed and the next day they feel better. It can really re-traumatize people sometimes. It can lead to induction of manic symptoms in some individuals, inductions of psychotic symptoms for people who have a predisposition. And so in those cases, we're talking about after the drug is worn off and it's out of the system, the people are still going to be dealing with these negative effects. And it could lead to you know, issues for weeks or months or even for the rest of somebody's life if they have, again, one of these specific conditions that they're predisposed to. And so that's really where all the screening comes in, because we want to make sure when we're going into the process that these people are not at risk of developing some of these ongoing problems after a high dose experience.
I've been thinking about this idea of, which I've read before in psychedelic therapy, of returning the patient to a childlike state or kind of shattering apart that crystallization that happens in certain thought pathways. And I'm wondering if some of those adverse outcomes might maybe are related to that. You're sort of blowing it apart and then it's recrystallizing, but recrystallizing in a way that isn't maybe less helpful than it was before. Does that make sense as a model? Is that kind of the working idea of what's happening?
Yeah. And you can also think of this in terms of ego integrity. And for some individuals, you know, it's the ego integrity is sufficient so that you can sort of dismantle the ego temporarily and it will generally come back together in a way that is functional and safe for that individual. But for other folks, they may already be struggling with poor ego integrity. That might mean that they may be on the precipice of struggling with some pretty intense mental health challenges. And then by having that experience, it may actually cause a fragmentation or some sort of destabilization that's ongoing. And then there's a difficulty reintegrating the ego afterwards. And so that person can continue to have a hard time dealing with and functioning after these big experiences. And so that's, again, why it's really important to have all of the safety, risk management, preparation and integration all around the dosing sessions.
The last thing I'm wondering about is the training of therapists to help guide people through and do some of that reconsolidation after. What does that training regimen look like? How do you train therapists to know what's normal and what's not? And I guess this is a two-parter. Do you think it's necessary for therapists to have experienced a psychedelic trip themselves?
Yeah, the first part of the question, you know, is still to be decided, because at this point, there really is no legal psychedelic therapy available outside of ketamine. And with ketamine therapies that are out there, there's no protocol that's accepted as a consensus. So some people will give the drug with no therapy. Some people will give the drug with different kinds of therapy. They'll use different doses of the drug, and they'll use it for different conditions. So it's pretty up in the air there. But with MDMA moving closer to an approval status, at least in the U.S., what seems to be coming up will be through FDA, certain types of requirements for training that therapists who are doing MDMA treatment will have to go through. And so that is already being focused on by MAPS. They're building out a training program for therapists who want to use MDMA therapy for PTSD. And you know, a lot of that has been really helpful. I've gone through that training myself, and you know, you get to both witness some of the drug dosing sessions, the preparation, and talk to some of the therapists who are very experienced, like Dr. Michael Mithoffer, Annie Mithoffer, who have done a lot of this work. And so when you get to work with these, you know, therapists, when you get to see how they're doing things and have them explain to you in real time, you know, what it is that's happening, what they're thinking in terms of the rationale for certain types of interventions, then that's really informative and helpful. And so I imagine that type of training is also going to be coming down the line for things like psilocybin therapy. And, you know, here at our lab at Hopkins, you know, we've had the privilege of having very experienced psychedelic guides like Bill Richards and Mary Casamano, who have done hundreds of these dosing sessions over decades. And so we have an apprenticeship model that makes it easy for someone like me to come in with a good training background and pick up some of the skills that are necessary to do this. But when, you know, there's very few people who have that level of experience, then it makes it hard to get that training out there and disseminate it. So it's something that I think the field is going to have to contend with over the next couple of years as we roll out towards implementation.
But it certainly seems like there's a lot of promising progress on both the scientific and the clinical fronts.
Yeah. And for the second part of your question, you know, in 1957, Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who coined the term psychedelic, so he's the first person who invented that word, you know, wrote in a paper specifically that if you are planning to give people psychedelics for research or clinical purposes, it would be good for you to have your own experiences with those. So that's what he said. You know, a lot of controversy has kind of ensued since the 1950s, obviously, around use of these substances. Their legal status as well, you know, makes this kind of a loaded question. But I do think that some level of familiarity with altered states of consciousness, whether that be through meditative practice, through different types of breath work, you know, through participating in different ceremonies that are available in indigenous settings and retreats, you know, those types of experiences can be helpful for people to then understand what it's like to have a sense of ego dissolution, or to understand what's going on in this process when their patients might be having a very intense high dose psychedelic experience. And if you haven't had that experience yourself, you know, how do you help contain that safely? That being said, I don't necessarily think it's a prerequisite. I think that there can be very good psychedelic therapists who may not have had personal experiences with these substances. So it really, you know, is going to be, again, another open question on this front.
Well, thank you so much for answering some of my questions today, Dr. Albert Garcia Romeo. Thanks for joining me on Modern Minds.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us this month on Modern Minds. Next month, we're taking a look at deprescribing in mental health. That's one that I hope is going to challenge you to think a little bit differently about the helpful and sometimes not so helpful role that medication has to play in treating mental health challenges. In the meantime, go back and check out some of our other conversations so far. We've talked about recovery, architecture, and team mental health, with lots more to come. Every episode is available in both audio and video on Spotify and YouTube, so go follow the show or me on either of those and get notified as soon as the next episode is up. We've also got audio-only versions of every episode on all the usual podcast platforms, like Apple Podcasts, Google, Amazon, Audible, iHeartRadio, and all of the other ones, too. If you have ideas for future topics or guests, make sure you get in touch with me. I'm on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, most of the other social platforms, at Mark Hennick, and also on my website, markhennick.com. So I look forward to talking with you again next time. Until then, I am Mark Hennick, and this has been Modern Minds.